Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Another riveting Rich Gaitis interview. This time, the get was Dana Kozlov at CBS. I mean, you just have to listen to these interviews and ask yourself, what is the point? And I mean that both sort of in a fatalistic way, like, why is this my time being wasted? But also in a more nefarious way, in terms of what does this tell me about Chicago politics, about City Hall and Chicago, the Chicago Press Corps, and the relationship between the two? That's, I think, the question you should be asking yourself as you hear these positively anodyne responses from Rich Gaitis to positively predictable, open-ended questions for which no follow-ups will come. Why'd you leave?
Why did you leave when you did?
Well, ultimately, obviously, I did say yes, but I told him I'd stick around for 1 year.
How would you characterize the state of the city today and its leadership compared to the past three decades and the prior three mayors?
In every administration anywhere, you're going to cross that intersection of major challenges. How they handled it, how they responded, how they communicated, ultimately is how everybody will be judged on it.
I learned so much. Thank you.
Boy, that's the kind of wisdom that only comes with 34 years in City Hall. assessment of Brandon Johnson?
So I think this mayor is 1 year in. We still have 3 years to go.
Exactly.
That's.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
That's so riveting. Mm-hmm. So informative.
Yeah.
Such insight.
I hadn't looked at it that way before, that he's 1 year in with 3 years to go.
That's all he said? What's going on with Dana? She's better than this. Come on.
I don't think she is, actually. I don't think so. I mean, it's the work product is the work product. So the question is, again, I mean, you were in it. So the relationship between City Hall and the Chicago Press Corps, and what does this interview tell you? On a little bit more color, which is something that probably is a word that's probably never associated with Rich Gaitis, color. But on BLM, is there room for improvement? Well, he gives you a real deep
answer.
Dive. you get this insight into the man, BLM Brandon Johnson, and some perspective on what is possible prospectively.
Being a year into his mayoral term, you know, we'll see what some of the things that he thinks that he could have done better. In the next 3 years, we'll see if he pivots and makes some changes in some of the stuff that you're mentioning. I think he's a people person. I think he is labor responsive.
Oh. After working with you, Dan, I hope nobody asked me. Dan, he's labor responsive. He's not really good with people, but he does
definitely
care.
A people person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, that's riveting.
People. He's a people person. Labor responsive. That's a fun term.
I work with Justin Kosick. He's labor responsive.
He's not a whole. he's not a wholly owned subsidiary of the Chicago Teachers Union. He's not getting his strings pulled by Stacey Davis Gates. He is not a apparatchik of the communist element within the public sector union movement. No, no. It's just labor responsiveness is what you're seeing. I can't wait to see how labor responsive he is to CTU's 36% over 4-year raise increase, part of the demands they're making for their next contract. I bet he turns out to be just as Gaitis described him, very labor responsive. Labor responsive. You're not a toady. You're labor responsive. I love the additions to the Orwellian dictionary. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. One more.
Please tell me there's more.
One more philosophical tract from Rich Gaitis. And then maybe we can offer some assessment of what exactly he's doing. If we're going to start from the premise that he's not a complete doofus, which I do not start from that premise. I don't think he's a doofus. So there's something else afoot here. Rich Gaitis on Mayor Brandon Johnson's relationship with the business community. Maybe that's an area for improvement.
I think the business community relationship is something that he probably has circled for attention for the next 3 years.
That's been circled for attention. You know, the relationship with the business community, that's not something you do in year one. You ease into concern about the economic vitality of the city. That's a year two, three project, I think.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So what do you think Gaitis is doing here? First with Marian Ahern at 5 and NBC, now Dana Kozlov at CBS. What do you think is afoot here? He's doing these interviews to offer this banality. There's got to be something else, isn't there?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also text us on our text line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. I don't know, I mean, there's, as I said with the Marian Ahern interview, you get the get, but you don't get the goods. I mean, he's not saying anything, but why is he doing it? Why is he still staying out there in the public eye?
And why doesn't Marian Ahern or Dana Kozlov say, Rich, people person, labor responsive, what the hell are you talking about? So is it your position that you're not going to say anything constructively critical of the Brandon Johnson administration? Are you just a company man here to protect the shield, as it were, to protect City Hall, say it's not that bad? I'm still volunteering with DNC planning and so on and so forth. So what is the point here? Are you trying to calm the tensions or lift the spirits of Chicago? What are you doing? Don't tell me that he's a people person and he's labor responsive. But instead, the reporters sit there dutifully and it's, okay, I have the next question here. And the next question is the business community. Go. It's good. What are both parties doing is the question. And I think it's sort of belied in the description I just offered, which is to say Gaitis is using the media to demonstrate that he's a company man, that he's a good soldier, because his new gig is security contracts with the city and the county. He works for a security firm that provides services for the city, the county, but probably the state. I mean, he has an interest. He also wants to send the signal, whatever other relationships he's developed throughout the years in and around government, that he's a good soldier. He's not going to break bad publicly, that everybody at least associated with Gaitis, including Gaitis, will be able to wet their beaks with this mayor.
And I'm sure he's going to be busy during August with the DNC here.
Well, you mean on the private sector side?
Right.
Yeah, right. I mean, right. The interesting thing is some enterprising reporter down the road 6 months from now goes to look at the company Guidus works for and see what kind of contracts they're receiving. And hey, I'm not saying I'm just saying, look, there's an agenda here that's not just, oh, yeah, Rich Guidus just out of civic duty is sitting down to answer these, again, juvenile, mindless questions from the juvenile and mindless government-run Chicago Press Corps. But the Chicago Press Corps is playing the role, too. They're platforming Guidus to tap everything down. It's not that bad. Guidus isn't breaking bad. He sees, the guy just said, the city is on an upward trajectory.
Yeah, because he said so.
And so this is all putting the proverbial perfume on the pig. And both Guidus and the Chicago Press Corps are in service of those beautiful lies, of the fiction, of the redefinition, labor responsive. Wonderful. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about Rich Guidus, and this is a text from the Amish Texter, which provides a neat little segue. Maybe we should thank Rich Guidus for some new innocuous Marxist Democrat PR language. The Democrats in Ivy League are terrorist responsive. Yeah, like Brandon Johnson is labor responsive.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Not bad. Yeah. Not bad. Terrorist responsive. Speaking of terrorist responsive, Mike Johnson, House Speaker, and a contingent of House Republicans, including New Yorkers, descended on the campus of Columbia to basically say to Jewish students that we have your back, to Columbia University, you're not doing enough.
Yeah, he wants the president to be fired or do something.
Here was some of what Mike Johnson had to say about the climate.
Our feeling is that they have not acted to restore order on the campus. This is dangerous. This is not free expression. This is not First Amendment. They are threatening, intimidating, saying that they will take violence upon Jewish students. We met with Jewish students who are in fear. They can't come on campus. They can't study for their final exams. This affects everybody's lives, and it affects the image that we portray to the world. This is not who we are as Americans, and it's time to act like
this. Right, the Columbia president should step down, and after he left Columbia, he said he would be on the blower to the big guy, and it's time for the National Guard.
My intention is to call President Biden after we leave here and share with him what we have seen with our own two eyes and demand that he take action. There is executive authority that be appropriate. If this is not contained quickly, and if these threats and intimidation are not stopped, there is an appropriate time for the National Guard. We have to bring order to these campuses. We cannot allow this to happen around the country. We are better than this.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. It's already happening. I mean, University of Texas, they brought sleeping bags and tents. 39 people were arrested. They did not let them set up shop. University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, they have an encampment. USC, or 100 people were arrested. They tried to do the same thing. So it's in every college campus right now.
Well, it's in a lot of them. But the response is very different. The response from Governor Greg Abbott at UT is a lot different than the response from Kathy Hochul in New York vis-a-vis Columbia, isn't it? In fact, here's what Hochul had to say about Mike Johnson's visit after she privately visited with the Columbia University president, clearly to no great effect.
It seems to me there's a lot more responsibilities and crises to be dealt with in Washington. I'd encourage the speaker to go back and perhaps take up the migrant bill, the bill to deal with closing the border so we can deal with a real crisis that New York has. So I think politicizing this and, you know, bringing the entourage to put a spotlight on this is only adding to the division.
Is she blind? I mean, these terrorists, domestic terrorists, they went from, you know, shouting free, free Palestine to going after the police and throwing water bottles at them, glass bottles at them, chairs, and they have a new chant. They morphed into this now.
NYPD, go to hell!
NYPD, go to hell!
The idea, but that's, I mean, how could she not know what's going on in her own state? Police officers are under attack, and this encampment, they're not cleaning up anytime soon. They said another 48 hours.
By the way, it's really something to witness when a proponent of sanctuary cities and open borders tells the conservative House Speaker to go back to Washington to move legislation to close the borders. How is it that New York, remind us again, how is it that New York became a destination for migrants, courtesy of Governors Abbott and DeSantis, Abbott in particular? Because you're proponents of open borders. But okay, sure. Someone else who agrees with Kathy Hochul and took it one step further. Well, of course she did. Brotherly love spice. It's not just a political spectacle that is exacerbating division in a time when we need to unify around terrorist sympathizers, so they argue. Speaker Johnson yesterday did something worse than that, according to Brotherly Love Spice. Remember, her daughter is on the front lines there.
And it is not surprising that he would go out to Columbia University and stir up really more anger and hate and endanger the lives of young people who are at the encampment at Columbia University.
Endangering lives.
See, he's endangering lives. The police are endangering lives. The people that are not endangering lives are the people that are just in these utopian communes that have been set up where people live in peace and harmony and peacefully protest against genocide. I mean, except when they attack Jewish students.
Right. And Jewish people can't go in their encampment. Here's Sueda Soloff. I wanted you to meet her. She's in charge of the Columbia encampment. She spoke to NBC.
It's part of our commitment to being in the space, keeping it nonviolent, free of harassment, and open to people regardless of any political belief.
Yeah, right. And then if somebody comes in with a Jewish flag, what do they do to them?
Yeah, regardless of political beliefs, but no Jews.
Yeah, but no Jews.
Yeah, we got it. VDH had a good take, as he normally does, on the tribal politics that we're see playing out in college campuses. And this cannibalization that's happening among the identitarians, exactly what Thomas Sowell said in that really seminal interview with Peter Robinson to promote his latest book a couple of months ago that I reference intermittently because it's such a powerful exchange that should provoke a lot of consideration, but it doesn't in enough quarters. If the identitarians got everything they wanted, was the question, what would people be doing? What would we be doing? And Thomas Sowell's response is we'd be killing each other. And you're seeing an approximation of that playing out right now. That's identitarian politics. That's the dead end of identitarian politics. VDH last night on Hannity on this very topic.
We've never been in this territory. We have 55 million people who were not born in the United States. That's the highest number in our history and the highest percentage. Almost 15% with the latest 10 million. We don't authenticate them. We don't do background checks. We don't even try to integrate and assimilate them. So they are tribal. We say your tribal fides, not your American or your shared residence, is what counts. And then we shouldn't forget this diversity, equity, inclusion. It's really pernicious in two ways. It says that if you're so-called non-white, you can't be discriminatory, you can't be racist, you can't be anti-Semitic, and the world is divided into oppressors and oppressed, and the Israelis and the Jews are oppressive white people, and therefore you get a complete pass to say whatever you want. And the second aspect of it is, we don't even have the SAT anymore to go to these elite schools in most cases. And Yale gives 80% A's. The rest of the Ivy League is close behind. These students are not taking rigorous courses. They have plenty of time. They're gut courses. And these universities are intent on racing to the bottom because they're letting in students by their own admission would never have been admitted according to their own standards just 4 or 5 years ago, and now the students are running the university and they determine the grade policy, the types of courses that are offered, and they're in control, and the presidents are terrified of them.
Mm-hmm. Again, something that Shelby Steele observed in White Guilt 20 plus years ago in that book, that he observed on campus at Coe College some 50 years ago, and that he wrote about a few years ago as our culture was descending into this identitarian madness, the culture of deference. And that's another aspect of what you're seeing in play. The foundation is identity politics. The onslaught is facilitated by deference. No one has the moral authority to say anybody is wrong. Anybody is coloring outside the lines. Anybody should be restrained from doing anything. And that includes university presidents, and that is perhaps most pronounced on college campuses, which have been completely given over to this identitarian mob mentality. And the streets of urban centers is another good example of it. That's what VDH is talking about. That's what you're saying. Is that what you want to subsume America? It's the Andrew Sullivan formulation from a few years ago. We all live on a college campus now.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. We're all a border town now. Well, we're all at war with identitarian mobs to the extent anybody wants to put up resistance now. So it's almost like we're all on a college campus now 2.0. Roger, Southside.
Good morning, Dan, Amy. Yeah, it's disheartening. Having children that went through college, it's disheartening to see this. Because here's the thing. You know, when I meet somebody as an older gentleman who's just got in college or gotten out of college, even if it's an Ivy League school, I immediately have doubt in them. I have no faith in this generation's ability to actually get anything done, because like you said, the system has been skewed, especially at these Ivy League or these premier schools, the University of Chicago's, you know, the whole admission program, the who's who, the endowments, the we need this percentage of minorities. I mean, it's a joke. At the root of it all, and I stand firmly on this. Why is it every failing these universities, the fall people or our elected officials are always women? Are they the easy target for these Marxists?
Well, you're talking about university presidents like the Ivy Leagues that have been the Claudine Gays and the Liz McGills. And so, it's not just women and it's not just women who are to blame here in positions of authority. People that are adherents to this identitarianism that I've discussed. That's the commonality. It just happens to be that it drives more women and more male impersonators into positions of authority because they're weak, right? Thanks for the call, Roger. I mean, that's weakness. Weakness of the mind, weakness of the spirit. Our friend Gad Saad, who's an evolutionary behavioral scientist, he tweeted recently, and this is not a new prediction, but there's a little bit more meat to it. And I'm not necessarily subscribed to this, but he writes, for many years now, I've warned that the path the West is taking will result in civil war. Might take 5 years, 50 years, or 100 years, but it is inevitable. The West could have repeatedly resolved these issues peacefully, but it refuses to autocorrect from its path of civilizational suicide. Many Western men who are currently asleep at the wheel will wake up and realize they don't like being pushed around in their homelands. They don't like their women attacked. They don't like their freedoms curtailed. They don't like their faiths disrespected. Once this happens, prepare for some gargantuan ugliness. Those who think that they are gaining inroads in the West will soon find out that not all Western men are invertebrate castrati. Save this tweet and never forget who warned you. Yeah, I think there's some insight there, and I don't know what the time horizon is either, but I do know that everyone has a breaking point. Just not bad enough yet for enough, I guess, for a revolt. And you want that revolt to happen peacefully through things like elections. But if you, as Gad Saad writes, refuse to autocorrect from the path of civilizational suicide, it's like anything else. The longer you wait to tackle a problem, particularly when people are getting hurt, and then the more people who are hurt and hurt severely, the more difficult it is going to be to tackle that problem.
Yep.
Mike, Southside.
Hey, what's going on, Dan and Amy? How are you guys doing this morning?
Good.
Dan, so I was telling the guy that answered, I was telling him, you know, I've always been raised like, you know, Israel is just as good as America. I kept seeing all these protests downtown, so I went to one to see what it was about. And a majority of the people that were protesting were, like, Jewish people and, like, everyday people. I actually discussed it with one of them who schooled me on, like, I don't know if I'm being brainwashed or what, but I was always raised, like, you know, Israel is the second America, like, hand to heart. But I don't know, man.
I don't know about a second America, but it's an ally, and obviously this country was founded on a Judeo-Christian ethos. So there is spiritual affinity as well as socio-political cultural affinity. But but what don't you understand now from attending the protest?
Well. So the majority of the people that were protesting were Jewish people. They weren't like Middle Eastern people. I'm telling you, like the large scale of that group, the guts of the group were Jewish people. And they were telling me all types of things that I couldn't believe about the Israeli government. And
well, here's what I would say about that. One is, there's self-loathing Jewish people. There are Jewish people who are not particularly religious. Jewish is cultural to them. Yeah. They don't like Netanyahu because they're leftists. And their real religion is the identitarian ideology that I've been describing. So once you prioritize a political ideology over, say, God, you can call yourself whatever you want, but you're on the path to civilizational suicide, as Gad Saad mentioned. Thanks for the call, Mike. Appreciate it.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Why are young people so upset? Why do they feel so hopeless, anxious? Scott Galloway is this NYU business school professor who is having a moment. He's been on that ghastly Morning Joe show over the last couple of days, first talking about what's happening on college campuses. We talked a little bit about what he had to say yesterday. And now, more generally, talking about basically Gen Z in particular. Millennials to Gen Z, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, millennials would be included in this.
Don't forget about them.
No, I won't. Never.
They're very important people. If they haven't told you, you should know that.
Yeah. So the it's basically sort of like the 35 and under crowd. Something is happening to them, and they're not too happy with their elders. And here's Galloway's distillation of that dynamic. See if you agree.
For the first time in our nation's history, a 30-year-old man or woman isn't doing as well as his or her parents were at 30. That is the social compact breaking down. People aged 30 to 34, 60% of them in 1990 had one child. Now it's 27%. People are opting out of America. They're not optimistic about it. They're not having kids. Young people aren't having sex. They're not meeting. They're not mating. The pool of emotionally and economically viable men shrinks every day, which lessens household formation. So we have a real issue. Young people are enraged. So it turns every cut, every movement into an opportunistic infection because, quite frankly, they are just pissed off. They look up, they see wealth, exceptional wealth across my generation and people in certain industries, and they are really struggling. Their purchasing power is going down, and the incumbents create artificial scarcity on campus. We take pride in rejecting 90% of our applicants, so the incumbents who already have a degree see their degree go up in value. We get very concerned with housing and traffic once we own the housing. Housing permits are sequestered from young people. Housing prices have gone from 290 to 420 in the last 4 years. So a young person, a house, stocks that I don't own, skyrocket in value. Let's have COVID relief and flush the markets and take assets way up, because if a million people dying would be bad, would be tragic if I got less wealthy. And we're doing it on their credit card. Young people have every reason to be enraged, and every issue they see, they look up, they get angry, and they see someone doing better than them. And then every day it is speedballed in their face that they are failing, that they are not doing as well as everyone around them. We have lost the script. Our kids are more anxious and more depressed and more obese and more addicted. And we have made a purposeful decision to let this happen by ensuring the people around this table stay wealthy at the cost of young people.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Does that sound like any 30 or 35 and under person that you know?
Yeah. I fear what he was saying too, like they're not even dating. It's so strange. When we were in high school, we dated other people, right, Dan? Or maybe you didn't?
Well, I attempted to, but there was not a lot of receptiveness.
You didn't go to any proms. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. But I just think that
I'm not emotionally viable. Right. I'm one of those people that he was talking about.
No, I just think that this whole, COVID didn't help at all on the social aspect of it, but I just feel like we're not raising men to be men. And, you know, the importance of getting married, starting a family, procreating, keeping the family name alive. I mean, I've stressed that with my boys all the time because I hear them say things like, oh, I don't think I'm going to get married. And like, why? You don't know yet. You don't know.
No.
You have no idea. You're still young. But I don't know. I think he was spot on, and I'm worried about our future. I'm worried about these kids right now, and I would like some advice on what to do.
Well, I mean, part of what he's saying is the social compact has been broken, and I think that part is right. The we owe our ancestors and our progeny, right? That, you know, we're supposed to take what our ancestors left us and improve upon it for our progeny. And what Professor Galloway is saying is that, we haven't done that because for the first time, people under 30 are a majority are not doing as well as their parents at the same age. And so he's talking about it economically. But of course, you know, this is all interconnected. When you struggle economically, there's all sorts of other negative outgrowths of that, the anxiety, the depression, the addiction that he referenced as well, a lack of fulfillment. And men and women are not just economic beings, but your ability to be independent and to do something that you derive value from has a psychosocial impact on you and those around you. I mean, I think that's pretty straightforward. Not raising men to be men, you know. Mm-hmm. That's part of it. So the kind of coming of age experience of people that are 30 and under in the in family and with respect to the mediating institutions in society where they have interacted. What about that? Does that have something to do with it? I mean, it's too easy to just, the purchasing power, Bidenflation, the COVID lockdowns. Yes, 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 yes. They're all contributing factors, but what's sort of the fundamental issue? Well, if you're looking for a fundamental issue, you go to fundamental institutions, family, faith, and the mediating institutions in society, like schools, sports, social organizations. And so, what's the assessment of 30 and under's interaction in those environments? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Ron, Southside.
Dan and Amy, I don't get it. Well, all I can say, I am very, very happy and pleased. Next week, our entire family will be going to Belize. My son.
Belize? Oh, are you going scuba diving?
Blue hole?
Yeah.
Come on, Ron. You know you want to do it.
Are you going to find the McAfee? Is McAfee still down there?
Damn, going to smoke good cigars like they are getting married there.
Oh,
okay. And,
destination wedding.
32, yes. So this stuff that I hear, and I raised him to be a man, and I am very, very happy for him. And he's going to do the traditional thing there, getting their home built and all this. So this stuff that I hear, I just don't get it. But I just hate to say that. That's not all young people.
No, no. So wait, what does your son do?
Dad, he's getting his PhD now.
Really?
And she has a PhD in nursing.
Okay.
UIC does family counseling, but they are finishing their education will be completed, and we starting family, and I'm just very, very happy for them. So I just had to put that in.
Well,
it's not all young people.
Yeah.
So I'll talk to you all. Before I go, bring your cigar back, Dan.
All right. Please do. Yeah.
Congratulations, Ron.
Congratulations.
Thank you all so much.
And do you think they're going to come back from Belize, or are they just going to set up shop down there?
You know what? That's totally up to them.
Yeah, exactly.
No, right.
The best thing about letting them be independent, that they can do exactly what they want. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Ron. Oh, a destination wedding in Belize. That's good. Well, no, of course it's not all young people 30 or 35 and under, but we're saying a majority. There's this precipitous decline, and the data bears this out, precipitous decline in the percentage of young people under the age of 30 doing better than their parents economically when they were 30. This is sort of how you test how well the social compact is being managed. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, it's a majority who are not doing as well. That's different, and it's a multifaceted equation, multivariate equation to solve, a multifaceted problem. But, I just go back, I mean, right to Ron's point, right, so his son's interactions with his family and mediating institutions, well, I think sounds like they were pretty positive. But is that the majority's experience, even if they don't fully appreciate it? Institutions that are increasingly hardwired to turn them into political, really intolerant, insufferable political activists, as opposed to individuals who are balanced and have marketable skills. This is what VDH was talking about in that clip we played before the break. With respect to the descent of the Ivy League, not just into the madness you see on campus, but into the dilution of the quality of the education. Monica and Lyle.
Yeah, I was just going to say, since when is it my fault, my husband's fault, or the parents' fault sometimes for these kids' decisions? They need to start taking ownership of themselves. I my kids made their decisions about where they want to go to school, what they want to do with their lives. We supported them. If they need help, we'll help them. But, you know, be an adult. Grow the hell up.
Yep. Thanks for the call, Monica.
That's a good mom right there.
Yeah, I don't know that it's necessary. I mean, I don't think there are a lot of adults running around across the generations. I don't think that it's just, Gen Xers or baby boomers that are the responsible party for the breaking of the social compact. I think it's up and down the generational continuum, isn't it? I mean, I think I've said this before, referenced it before, and I'm not the only one, that the great Roman historian Livy's observation predicting essentially the end of the Roman Republic a decade before it actually happened, that Roman society had gotten to a point where people could no longer tolerate their vices nor their cures. Hmm. So I think that's where we're generally at. We cannot tolerate our vices, the profligate spending, living beyond our means, and imposing those costs on subsequent generations. And that started with World War II generation, but it really escalated exponentially with the baby boomers. So, you know, this has been going on for some time, but now that's just created a culture where everybody wants to live off everybody else. Cannot tolerate our vices nor the cures to those vices. And so we're in this stasis, really, where we just allow the vices to drive the culture because we can't see our way fit to make the sort of substantial changes that are required to mute the impact of those vices. And that's not specific to 30 and under. Michael in Arlington Heights.
Morning, Dan and Amy.
Morning.
I work for a Fortune 10 company. I'm coming up on third year. I had to work my way up. I started with $17,000 a year and 1 week vacation. Now everybody that's coming on board, our company has to change their policy. So all the new people had to get all their vacation up front, start, you know, almost all the way up in the pay scale. I blame this on the everybody gets a trophy. Nobody wants to work hard anymore. Nobody wants to work to get their golden ring.
Thanks for the call, Michael.
Again,
the entitlement mentality, that's something that is unique to millennials or Gen Z, is it?
Yeah, everybody. Yeah. Depends on the person.
I mean, look at Illinois up and down the age demographics. We bought into the idea of being bribed with our own money. Pennies on the dollar, by the way, for most of us, for productive people. But we completely bought into the kleptocrats' culture. The millennials and the Gen Z didn't do that to Illinois. It happened well before they were impactful. Thomas Sowell, mentioned him before, mentioned him again. I like to reference, you know, people that are smarter than me. There's not that many. Thomas Sowell is one of them. I thought that would draw a guffaw, a moan. Thomas Sowell on this. And so here's maybe where the older folks have failed. So I go back, family, meeting, and institutions. Because millennials and Gen Z, not in charge of much. Maybe a few tech companies, but not much. Thomas Sowell wrote, "We are born into this world poor and ignorant and with thoroughly selfish and barbaric impulses. Those of us who turn out any other way do so largely through the efforts of others who civilized us before we got big enough to do too much damage to the world or ourselves. But for these efforts, we might well be on welfare or in the penitentiary. We owe gratitude for those efforts, not guilt for those who didn't get them. We certainly cannot make it up to those without values by easing standards and letting them become a burden and a threat to others. That is buying a good conscience or a good image with an IOU to be paid by somebody else. Those who want to share their good fortune can share the sources of that good fortune, the skills, values, and discipline that mean productivity. Those who want to ease their burden of guilt should seek professional help at their own expense, not make policy at everyone else's expense." Yeah, that's the stuff right there. As usual, Thomas Sowell bringing the stuff.
Bringing the heat.
Mike and Dixon.
Yeah, you know what? Why should it be any different when these younger people can have their cake and eat it too? And I'm talking especially about the guys. They can still have sex. They can, without commitment, they can still live in mom and dad's basement without having to really pay anything. So, you know, it works both ways, too, because the parents are accommodating them for this lifestyle, and there's no commitment. It's just lazy, do what you want, and that's what I think a lot of it
well,
is.
Well, I agree, and I tell you, I blame Obamacare on this. Everything was fine, people would be motivated to get out of the house, because you're off your parents' insurance when you graduate from college. And then they extended it to 26, and I think that's where laziness set in. Like, I don't have to get a job because I can just have my parents take care of me under their insurance.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of infantilization that's at the hands of government that's happened. That's a good example of it. But, you know, the where are the parents? It's like where are the parents of these rabid anti-Semitic, bigoted, ignorant protesters at Columbia, at Yale, at NYU.
If my son, any of them, were involved in this, I would go to the campus and yank them by their ear and tell them to get up. But they're too smart. They know what's going on.
Well, so where are the parents, right? So the culture of deference, is not just propagated by university presidents or Fortune 500 CEOs. It's also, there's contributions made by parents too. Defer, defer, defer. I don't have the moral authority to lay down the law with my kids, particularly my, you know, adult kids at an Ivy League school. There's a lot of that too. Don't kid yourself. Tom in Oswego.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I've got three adult children, and I think some of the issues are breakdown of the family. And Dan, like you said, the parents are afraid to discipline their children. My children grew up with a discipline. I didn't have to spank them or hit them, but there was consistency in the discipline. The other thing that I've noticed with rise in anxiety levels among children, even adults, is the technology. And I'm not blaming it all, but it has something to do with it. I see kids and adults on their phones constantly, and any change, economic change, any social change, it can happen in a heartbeat. So they can wake up in the morning feeling good. It's a nice day. I got a raise. And then 10 minutes later, they look on the news and say that somebody raised my taxes. Now I'm going to lose my increase. And they start feeling bad. And this up and down all day is exhausting on the mind. And I think that it's wearing the kids down. There's lack of leadership in our government. There always has been. But now it's visible. It's in their face every day. And they just don't, one, trust or respect adults anymore to make good decisions to help them get better. It's a lot of issues going on all at once. But to me, it starts with the family. When the kids are young, discipline, consistency, of course, love in the family, and teaching, not just discipline. You have to also teach them what they're doing wrong and then how to correct it. And as they get older, they'll learn those skills. They'll learn how to overcome adversity. And when they get knocked down, they get back up. My kids, I'm blessed. They do that. And hopefully that's what we need to start doing with the kids these days.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for the call, Tom. Appreciate it. Good speech.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Trump is making fairly efficient use of his out-of-court time when it comes to campaigning. I saw he did so again with a group of New Yorkers.
Yeah, he made a campaign stop this morning on Park Avenue in New York City and met with some construction workers. And I loved it. You know, it was just an impromptu thing to do. And this is what you've suggested all along, like campaign before, campaign after the trial. Meet the people of New York. So they, of course, embraced him. And it was cool to see. I loved it.
Well, so while Trump is meeting with rank-and-file construction workers, the big guy, Mr. 10%, President Biden, was speaking to the North American building trades, the chieftains of the trade unions. And, he rallied them as only Joe Biden can.
Imagine what we can do next. Four more years. Pause.
Four more years. Four more years. Four more years.
I mean, he read out loud the teleprompter instructions where in parentheses it says pause, and he said, pause. And you know what that reminds us of, Dan?
Well, that's going to do it for all of us here at Channel 4 News. You stay classy, San Diego. I'm Ron Burgundy.
Damn it! Who typed a question mark on the teleprompter? For the last time, anything you put on that prompter, Burgundy will read.
Hey. Biden went on after the four more years chanting died down to offer this.
And I'm Ron Burgundy. Go f*** yourself, San Diego.
Yeah.
Ah!
So anyway, all right. Well, that's that. Biden and Trump on the trail and Trump on the trials. For more on all of this, we're Pleased to be joined by our friend Roger Kimball, who's the editor of New Criterion. Roger, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
So you had a piece over at The Spectator about this trial in Manhattan in particular and what it signifies. We were just talking before you joined us a little bit about sort of the social compact breaking down between our ancestors and our progeny. And America being in this curious place where we, to borrow from Livy, we can neither tolerate our vices nor their cures.
Well, we're in a very strange situation now. You know, the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, prohibits bills of attainder because the founders of this country understood that making a law that targets one individual or one group is a synonym for tyranny. But that's exactly what's happened in the case of Donald Trump. I mean, the entire force of the police power of the United States has been directed to take out this one person. And the case that's going on right now in New York is, you know, illustrates that as graphically as possible. If you ask someone, what is the crime for which he is being tried? You know, people will just start gibbering because there is no crime. And if you look at the, what Alvin Bragg has done, it's, he's taken, a non-crime, and elevated into 34 felony counts. It's quite extraordinary what's happening now. It reminds you of a cross between Kafka and trials in the Soviet Union. You know, Beria, the Stalin's head of the secret police for Stalin, said, "Show me the man and I'll find you the crime." And that's exactly what's happened with Donald Trump.
Well, there's nothing illegal about paying someone for an NDA, you know, non-disclosure agreement.
No, well, apparently I haven't really looked into this, but I saw someplace yesterday that Joe Biden has NDAs with some 20 women. It would be interesting to look into that. Would not surprise me, but it's not a crime. That's the point. So they have taken this and elevated it into 34 felony counts. It's quite extraordinary.
You know, I haven't heard it quite characterized this way, but I was sort of struck by a conversation that a friend of the show, Lionel Shriver, had with Brendan O'Neill over at Spike. Lionel Shriver, the great author. We need to talk about Kevin and others. They were talking about social manias. You know, social manias, obviously COVID-19 comes to mind, mm-hmm. climate change, systemic racism, the non-existent trans genocide that is alleged. And Elena Shriver said this about manias and how they subside. She said, "My sense is they die very quietly, slowly, and tacitly. That is, they die when people stop talking about them. They do not die because people in power reverse their positions in public. And regardless of what the particular mania was, you'll never hear any apologies or recognition from the people who went nuts. They'll never disavow their past beliefs or actions. Very few will ever be held to account either. The people who brought in lockdowns are never going to pay a price. Those who do acknowledge their faults, such as the CDC in the U.S., will only do so in a tiny, quiet way. But you'll never see a CDC official admit the same things in public. The authorities will never recognize that they were caught up in hysteria and they were wrong. And then the people who went along with it just want to change the subject after people stop talking about it and are ready to prepare themselves for the next mania." And just that description, I think, is, explains very nicely or describes very nicely what has happened with some of the manias I mentioned. And this all leads to my question, is Trump one of those manias?
Well, yes. And this whole situation with Trump reminds me a little bit of that, the title of a book by Charles McKay called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, in which he goes through various manias, as you put it. The craze for tulip bulbs in Holland at one point, where a single bulb could cost more than your house. And then it grew, and then it just suddenly collapsed. I've never been able quite to get to the bottom of the Trump mania. The people who hate him. It's very strange. Is it aesthetic? No, maybe partly. It can't really be ideological because, if you look back on his first term, it was extraordinarily successful. I think of some of my friends or former friends who are on the never Trump right. And I want to ask them, well, what is it that you dislike about what he's done? Is it the fact that he made the country energy independent, that he had a sealed southern border, that he was able to get through a massive tax cut that increased tax receipts by 48% and helped 65% of taxpayers by paying lower taxes? Is it the fact that he was the best friend Israel's ever had, that he moved our embassy in Israel to Jerusalem when people told him it couldn't be done? The list goes on and on and on, what he did for the regulatory environment and so on. All these are all things that mainstream conservatives should like. So what is it that they hate about him? I don't really have the answer, but I think it is irrational. And then you go on to the left. Why does the left hate him the way they do? They love Donald Trump until he came down the escalator in 2016 to announce his candidacy. Then they just couldn't abide him. It has something to do, I believe, with the strange alchemy of our political life, where we people keep talking about our democracy. We have to say our democracy and so on. But we are not a democracy anymore. We are an oligarchy ruled by a tiny elite. And it's that tiny elite that Trump challenges. And people hate him for it.
Well, that's where the rubber meets the road in terms of understanding why it's different. I mean, the left called George W. Bush Hitler and Stalin, and I mean they call every Republican Hitler and Stalin. They make Mitt Romney was Hitler and Stalin, right?
Yeah, I know, so, I love that. Yes, at least it's Ronald Reagan. Every Republican has been literally Hitler. You can go back and look it up. It's quite true.
Yeah, but here's the difference.
Trump is special. Yeah.
Yeah, but the difference is, and this is where I think the over the top animus comes from, and the mania really. And they recognize exactly what Lionel Shriver is saying. We can't. There's no such thing as being over the top. We can hyperbolize this beyond all recognition because we'll never have a price to pay for it, whether we're in the justice system or we're in the public health sphere or the corporate America. We'll never ever pay a price. So let's make him as toxic as possible, because the one crime that Trump has committed. And I would keep talking about this. He will not defer. And they're used to Republicans. They're accustomed to Republicans like a Romney or a W for the most part. The country club set, compassionate conservative set will defer to them once challenged, that you're supposed to back down. You're supposed to do bipartisan deals with Chuck Schumer. You're supposed to facilitate a slower advance of our flag. We understand you have to slow it down to keep up appearances, but as long as you're still advancing our flag, even if it's at a slower pace than we would, that's what you're supposed to do as a Republican. And Trump comes over the top, and he comes really over the top. He'll punch down sometimes when he shouldn't, but everything is, you challenge me and I will challenge you 100 times over. And that's what they're not used to. That's what they can't abide.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's, what is the crime that Trump committed? It's having been elected and challenging this consensus. You're quite right to mention, Romney and Bush and so on. We don't live in a two-party system. We live in a one-and-a-half-party system. So the regime party is the left-wing Democratic Party. It's not, you know, it's not the Democrats of old. It is a new compact that represented by people like Chuck Schumer, by Adam Schiff, Nancy Pelosi. It's very left wing, and they control the government. Washington is it's ruling the country as a party state. So what I mean is that if we're going to take the country back, we're going to have to downgrade the place of Washington in the metabolism of our political life. You know, Jefferson wanted the capital to move from New York to the swamp where it is now, partly because it would be closer to Virginia, but also because he thought of it as neutral ground. But it's not neutral ground anymore, if it ever was. It is totally controlled by a left-wing consensus of this elite, these country club elites that you referred to. And if we cannot challenge that, we are going to lose the country. And we're right, I would say, we're on the threshold of losing the country right now. If this campaign against the former president of the United States is allowed to go forward and to destroy him, which is possible, that's it. You know, it will be, Christopher Wray's FBI dawn raids against people who are, dissident school board members or pro-life activists or people who have the wrong opinions. You know, I mean, this what happened to this this eminent lawyer and constitutional scholar, John Eastman? What is his tort? Well, he gave legal advice to Donald Trump. He said, if you want to challenge the 2020 election, here are several different ways in which you could do it. He, as a lawyer, gave the best advice he could to Donald Trump about possible responses to the 2020 election and Trump's apparent defeat. For that, he's just been disbarred. He may be indicted. His banks, the companies with which he did his business as a lawyer, they have just canceled his accounts. So he now has to find other banks. It's really quite extraordinary the way the regime will pick individuals that dissent from the ruling consensus and destroy them.
There's no question. By the way, Eastman has been indicted. He was indicted in Arizona yesterday.
Oh, was he? Okay. Yeah. Yesterday? Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And by the way, Eastman's account at USAA too for the military, right?
Oh, is that right? Okay.
His account. Yep. His account. I mean, you mentioned his banking account being. The USAA that serves veterans.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you know, it's as I'm fond of saying, things are always worse than they seem.
Yes, indeed. Roger Kimball, editor of New Criterion. Thanks so much for joining us, as always. Appreciate it, Roger.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A couple of updates before we get to the case in chief, as it were. About a dozen Northwestern student protesters have begun setting up an encampment on Deering Meadow. Of course, you're not going to leave the Northwestern Marxists and Hamas sympathizers out of the fun.
Are they going to let them stay there?
I would suspect that Michael Schill will be no more courageous than any of the Ivy League presidents. So we'll monitor that. Trump responding to former Attorney General Bill Barr's sort of backhanded endorsement of him the other day on Cavuto's show that we played, that, you know, he's supporting Trump, even though he didn't like some of his behavior. He liked his policies. And the real problem is the left. That's essentially what Barr said. Trump posting, wow, former AG Bill Barr, who let a lot of great people down by not investigating voter fraud in our country, has just endorsed me for president, despite the fact I called him weak, slow-moving, lethargic, gutless, and lazy. Based on the fact that I greatly appreciate his wholehearted endorsement, I am removing the word lethargic from my statement. Thank you, Bill. So now he is but a weak, slow-moving, gutless, and lazy, not lethargic.
Take that word out.
Well, one backhanded compliment deserves another, I suppose. It's just kind of fun. Yeah, look for some humor in these dire times. Speaking of the humorless, meet a different attorney general, this at the state level. She of Arizona, her name, Chris Mays, announcing indictments against Trump team members for their alleged scheme with an alternate slate of electors in Arizona. A number of people, like former chief of staff Mark Meadows, Rudy Giuliani, and it's believed that they'll be joined by Jenna Ellis, John Eastman, Christina Bob, Boris Epstein, Michael Roman on the list of those indicted in this alleged scheme. Here's Attorney General, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays making the announcement.
To the efforts that the defendants and other unindicted co-conspirators allegedly took to undermine the will of Arizona's voters during the 2020 presidential election. Arizona's election was free and fair. The people of Arizona elected President Biden. Unwilling to accept this fact, the defendants charged by the state grand jury allegedly schemed to prevent the lawful transfer of the presidency. Whatever their reasoning was, the plot to violate the law must be answered for, and I was elected to uphold the law of this state. A state grand jury made up of everyday, regular Arizonans has now handed down felony indictments for all 11 Republican electors, as well as several others connected to this scheme. These charges include fraud, forgery, and conspiracy. These charges are Class 2, 4, and 5 felonies.
For more on this and other legal wranglings, please be joined by Professor William Jacobson, clinical professor of law and director of the Securities Law Clinic at Cornell, founder of LegalInsurrection.com and president of the Legal Insurrection Foundation, as well as the Equal Protection Project. Professor Jacobson, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me back.
Help us understand those indictments handed down by the grand jury convened by Attorney General Mays in Arizona.
Yeah, I think the first thing people need to understand is that we're entering the final run of the 2024 election, which includes a very important Senate race in Arizona, and that timing cannot be ignored. Mm-hmm. These are events that took place 3.5 years ago. This indictment could have been brought 3 years ago or 2 years ago. There is a reason why it is being brought right now. It is to freeze the Arizona Republican Party so that they cannot organize themselves to win that Senate seat. That's what this is all about, and nobody should kid themselves. So whether there's merit to this indictment or there's no merit to the indictment, it should have been brought 1 or 2 years ago. There's a reason it's being brought right now. So that's the first thing that I think people need to understand, that this is not being brought in good faith. It's being brought as an electoral move. If it were not, if it were brought in good faith, it could have been indicted a year or two ago. So that's what is going on here.
So then we should expect, since Dana Nussel, the AG of Michigan, has a similar investigation ongoing, we should expect that indictment maybe right after Labor Day?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's going on this year. All of these Trump indictments, with the exception of the Mar-a-Lago one, which where the events took place later, all of these lawsuits, criminal prosecutions, are regarding events that took place over 3 years ago. They are brought so that the tr- trials will take place in this election year, including the one that's ongoing now in Manhattan, involves events 6 or 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. So this is a complete abuse by Democrat prosecutors of their power. As we know, you can get an indictment of just about anything. But again, regardless of the merits, why is it being done now? And we know why it's being done now. Going to the merits of it, the claim is that there was a fraud perpetrated on the Congress and the public regarding the Arizona election. The problem with that is that there was no deception. No one was deceived.
Correct.
This all took place in plain sight. It was in the media. People were on TV. They were going to present an alternative slate of electors in Arizona and other states. They thought the election was fraudulent. It said nobody was deceived by this. So that is the other thing you have to remember. This is presented primarily as a fraud case that they fraudulently tried to deceive, to deprive the voters of their vote. But nobody was deceived. Right. People disagreed. They run through in the indictment page after page after page of legal challenges. That just proves no one was deceived. They were fighting this. You can disagree with it. You can say Trump had no basis to do it. It was stupid. Whatever you want to say about it. But no one was deceived.
Right. Well, I mean, this perfectly follows. There was no crime committed in Manhattan. But there was something, that seems illicit or scandalous that was done. And so we'll get to what the crime is. So, you know, at some point, Arizona will get to maybe what the crime is. But for now, we'll just call it fraud, just like we're supposed to call it hush money. And since hush money sounds, underhanded, even criminal, then we don't need any sort of underlying crime per state statutes. We'll just go with the politically salacious.
And that's what's happening. I mean, this is really, frankly, disgusting that all of these prosecutions were delayed until an election year. They could have been brought earlier. Again, whether they have merit or not, fine. Bring your prosecution, but don't time it so as to paralyze one of the parties in an election year.
So just walk us through how this is going to affect Carrie Lake's Senate race.
Well, they've named, I forget the exact count, but several, at least several, senior Republican officials in Arizona. Mm-hmm. So they've essentially trying to freeze the Arizona Republican Party. That doesn't mean Carrie Lake can't run for office. She can. Oh. That doesn't mean she can't win. But when you paralyze a party, that has a huge impact. You'll remember, I think, the John Doe investigations in Wisconsin. I forget what the year was, many years ago, where they used the John Doe law in Wisconsin to investigate and raid virtually the entire Wisconsin conservative movement to freeze them. And that's what's going on here. These are prosecutions, the use of prosecutorial power to freeze a political party in an election year. And that's what people need to understand about it.
Well, it's more than freezing. What they're really going to do is now they've got this indictment, and now they're going to run tens of millions of dollars of ads saying the Arizona Republican Party leadership has been indicted for trying to steal the 2020 election, and Carrie Lake is their new puppet, and any other candidate running in Arizona is the puppets. They're all fruit of this poisonous tree of destroying our democracy, of a coup d'etat. And so that's what's going to happen. This is a messaging play in addition to freezing the Republican Party.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I assume they're going to do perp walks here, and that will be in TV ads. It's even worse than I describe it. Thank you for pointing that out. This is also campaign ad preparation. They are filming. They are getting ready to film their campaign ads.
Yeah, exactly.
People appear in court.
Yeah, right. The AG is the unindicted co-conspirator. She's the sort of the unidentified or unindicted, unidentified political consultant. She's setting up the shoot. That's exactly it. That's it. No, it's 100% it. I wanted to get something else, though, since I think Eastman is one of those indicted. We were just talking about this with Roger Kimball before you joined us. And, you know, the whole treatment of John Eastman, since he has been a bit of a flashpoint and he's been disbarred now and he's been indicted as part of the crew in Fulton County and now in Arizona. And again, you can disagree with John Eastman's legal theory and legal advice, and many do. But, you know, in your professional estimation, did he do something that was a disbarrable offense or an indictable offense by providing this advice and counsel, even if it wasn't shared by other, you know, similarly experienced attorneys?
No, I don't think he did. And I say that as somebody who, I think it was New Year's Eve or New Year's Day of that year, I wrote an article on my website that I do not think Mike Pence had any discretion in terms of accepting the electoral certificates, that there was no constitutional basis for the arguments that were being made, that he could just pick and choose and decide who he wants to win. So I say that as somebody who disagreed with John Eastman at the time, on the record. But, you know, they have not only criminalized politics, they have now criminalized lawyering if you're a Republican lawyer. So people make aggressive arguments in court all the time. People make arguments for the extension of the law. I think Eastman's argument was wrong. I don't think it rose to such a frivolous level that you should lose your bar license over it. I mean, that's very rare. That's very unusual. There was no fraud perpetrated on a court. There was just a legal theory and a legal argument that the courts disagreed with. So this is really disgusting what is happening in the country through the use of not just prosecutor's office, but now bar authorities. There is a group, I think they're called the 65 group or something like that, which is going around the country trying to get Republican lawyers disbarred. They have weaponized not just the Democrat prosecutorial offices, they are now weaponizing bar counsel, and they are now weaponizing the disciplinary process. And they have said explicitly, they advertise it, they want to make Republican lawyers toxic in their communities. So people need to wake up. What's going on in this country is really totalitarian, and it is an attempt to not enforce the rule of law, but to destroy the rule of law and to prevent Republicans from ever mounting an election challenge again. What Republican lawyer, if there is an alleged fraud in the next election, is going to dare to raise legal arguments against it, knowing that John Eastman has now been disbarred for that?
Speaking of cheerleading totalitarianism, I did want to get your comment on what is going on college campuses, Columbia, Yale, and, you know, the Ivy League again, as well as NYU and Berkeley. And as I mentioned at the outset, now apparently Northwestern and many others. And of course, the response is very different in places like Texas as compared to places like New York. Speaker Mike Johnson was at Columbia yesterday with a contingent of House Republicans, and he said, number one, the Columbia University president should resign. Number two, if the university doesn't take more substantial action to protect Jewish students, then he is calling on President Biden to scramble the National Guard. What's your reaction to all of that?
Yeah, well, I think people need to understand there is a radical element on the campuses that is in cahoots with the Islamists. It is no coincidence that the Grand Ayatollah, the Supreme Ayatollah in Iran, on Twitter issued statements supporting the protesters. Mm-hmm. Hamas did the same thing, and so did Palestinian Islamic Jihad terror group. So the terror groups are loving this. They are gaining strength from it. And what makes it different this time is that Islamist element. You have the extreme left, what I would refer to as the Khmer Rouge left, who want to tear down our society and start at year zero again, combined with the extreme Islamists who want to take us back to the 8th century. So this is not like the anti-war protests in the 60s. This is not even like the Black Lives Matter protests. This is a combination of extreme deconstructionist, so-called decolonization left with the religious, repressive Islamist terror groups. And we've not seen anything like this. And people need to wake up. What is wrong on our campuses that this is what's happening? And people need to understand that the campuses are the source of this problem.
Professor William Jacobson, clinical professor of law and director of the Securities Law Clinic at Cornell, founder of LegalInsurrection.com and president of the Legal Insurrection Foundation, as well as the Equal Protection Project. Professor Jacobson, thank you, as always, for your insights. Appreciate it.
Great. Take care.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Miguel Cardona, the Secretary of Education, he was playing possum when he was before that congressional committee last week, and he was asked by Georgia Representative Andrew Clyde to define a woman. He knows what a woman is. In fact, it's enshrined in the Biden administration's rewrite of Title IX. A woman is a person who identifies as a woman.
Exactly, and he made the announcement via social media Friday afternoon.
The final Title IX regulations we're announcing today advance that promise. These regulations make crystal clear that all our nation's students, no matter where they live or who they are, can access schools that are safe, welcoming, and respect their rights. This final regulation strengthens and restores vital protections against sex discrimination, including sexual harassment. It also protects students against discrimination based on pregnancy or related conditions, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Today's announcement is the result of a long rulemaking process, including input from many stakeholders, through the first ever national public hearing on Title IX and more than 240,000 comments, including comments from students. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's just a long way of saying we're including gender identity, right, so women's sports is over.
Right, but in the two-minute statement, that he never said that. And at the end, he said, for more information, go to, you know, edu.gov, blah, blah, blah.
Well,
to find out what's going on.
It's interesting. OutKick followed up on the query of South Carolina basketball coach Dawn Staley, who, of course, embroiled herself in controversy when she said before the championship game against Iowa that basically if you identify as a woman, you should be able to play women's sports. So they said, well, it's not fair just to put this on Dawn Staley. Let's ask, OutKick did, let's ask every coach of a Sweet 16 team in the most recently concluded women's NCAA tournament, including Lisa Bluder of Iowa.
Yeah.
Having a tough time tracking down Lisa Bluder. They've made several inquiries, as they document, but she went straight to recruiting, from recruiting to the NBA draft, WNBA draft, and then she also just doesn't really have time to respond to these two questions that they asked every coach. The two questions, I don't think it takes that long to answer them. Do you believe that transgender women should be allowed to compete in women's college basketball? Number one. Number two, why do you feel that way? Whatever way you feel. Here are the responses they received from the athletic departments of all the schools.
Oh, I can't wait.
Lisa Bluder, Iowa, no response. Corey Close, UCLA. Coach Close declines to comment on the questions below. So Kara Lawson, Duke. We will respectfully decline the opportunity to comment. Nikki Collin, Baylor. Appreciate you reaching out on this. We're going to decline to participate in the story. J.R. Payne, Colorado. Coach Payne will respectfully decline to comment on that time, at this time. Vic Schaefer, Texas. We'll pass on this one. Lindsey Gottlieb, USC. USC will decline to comment on this time. Kim Mulkey.
Oh, I love Kim Mulkey. Was she wearing a feathered boa?
Did not respond to request for comment. Gino Ariyama, UConn. Did not respond to request for comment.
Oh,
Neely Ivy, Notre Dame. Did not respond to request for comment. Tara Der Veer and Kate Payne retired at the end of the season. Did Tara? Kate's the new coach. Stanford did not respond. Wes Moore, NC State, did not respond. Terry Morin, Indiana, did not respond. Scott Ruek, Oregon State, did not respond. Lisa Fortier, Gonzaga, did not respond. Profiles encourage those women's basketball coaches. Really?
Mm-hmm.
You want men playing against your girls, do you? Riley Gaines recently sat down with Shade Steele, and Steele asked her an interesting question that she actually did respond to, because Riley Gaines has some courage here. And it was what Riley would say to the clownfish, Leah Thomas, if she was given the opportunity to speak with him.
Have you ever talked to him? Not outside of, no, no. At that meet, there was, of course, in the ready room and different things,
sure.
Very brief, small talk, but no, never.
If he walked in here right now,
I'd love it.
Today, what would you say?
I would want him to know that his actions displayed an utter disregard for us as women, which is, of course, what the women's sporting category was created to protect and uphold and celebrate. I would let him know that, look, I have no animosity towards him. I really don't. Like, I don't garner this hatred in my heart. Ultimately, he was following the rules. It's the rules that are the problem. And I would be sure to tell him that. I would be sure to tell him, look, live your life. Be who you want to be. Don't expect me to support it or affirm these delusions that you have, because you very much are a man. And that will never change. I would have no problem saying that to Thomas's face.
Yeah, so it's going to be, I guess, up to Riley. And this high school group of female shot putters, track and field athletes in West Virginia. People saw the video of the West Virginia High School Athletic Association allowing men to compete against girls in track and field events. So the girls on this team all got up for their turn to throw the shot put, and they picked up the shot put and they twirled a couple times, and then they just handed it back to the official.
Yep. And they
right?
did that with a discus too, because he was throwing that. He's in that competition as well.
So like five of them in a row. So those girls in West Virginia have more courage to stand up for themselves than the adults at the highest levels of female sports and at the collegiate level. And that's where we are. That's where we are. For more on all this, please be joined by Madeline Kern. She's a writer at National Review, visiting fellow at the Independent Women's Forum as well. Madeline Kern, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So the impact of the Title IX rewrite that Miguel Cardona soft-pedaled there, the NCAA has sort of played Pontius Pilate with it, waiting for this, and now they've got their directive, and so we're going to see more Leah Thomases, right?
Absolutely. So it's difficult to overstate just how sweeping this Title IX omnibus rule is. So it covers everything from due process rights, so it rolls back the due process protections that Betsy DeVos under the Trump administration put in place to make sure that if you're accused of sexual misconduct on campus, you get fair hearing. Those are gone. It also, as you rightly outlined, it includes gender identity in the definition of sex, which basically collapses sex-based protections for women. Because if it counts as discrimination against women to decide that a man shouldn't be in a women's sports team or in a women's space, then forget women's safety, forget women's privacy. And the important thing to note here is this is not just college and high school. This is every educational entity in the United States that receives even a dime of federal funding. So this is incredibly sweeping legislation. There's also stuff in there that's going to be really damaging for parental rights, children being transitioned behind their parents' backs at schools. I mean, it's like I say, it's the worst of the worst. It's also flagrantly illegal, flagrantly unconstitutional. We'll give you an example of that. This is also going to affect free speech. So one way of defining sex-based harassment under the new Title IX regulations is that using sex-based pronouns when somebody wants you to call them she or her or their a new female name, that would technically be sexual misconduct. That would be sexual harassment. That's constitutionally protected speech. This is complete executive overreach. And my colleagues at the Independent Women's Law Center already have a lawsuit ready to go to challenge this.
So what's a qualifier for what is a woman?
Well, as you said, the only thing you need to qualify as a woman is to say you're a woman, which is obviously absurd because we know what women are. Women are a biological category. They're people who are of the female sex. There's also, you know, people aren't in bodies. That's a sort of strange metaphysical claim. People are bodies and we can see them. Sex is not just only objective and immutable. It's observable. We know this. It's just common sense.
Well, and this is really important that the point that you made about this, how expansive this is, that it's going to, that it reaches down into K through 12 school systems too, because we know how so many of these government school systems operate. You know, on the advice of counsel, we're going to surrender. Which is exactly what's going to happen. So anybody who's accused of anything or anybody that makes a demand of anything, they will defer. They will surrender, not dissimilar to what you're seeing on college campuses right now in the face of pro-Hamas protesters.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you made the point really well when you're kind of pointing to the abdication of leadership and actual, frankly, cowardice among these coaches. That's what you're going to see at the schools as well, because the schools don't want to be investigated by the Civil Rights Office. They don't want the lawsuits. They don't want the headache. They don't want the hassle. And so it's easier for them just to throw women under the bus and to give these trans activists what they want and what the Biden administration is telling them they have to give. And it's just disgraceful, especially when you consider the legacy of Title IX was exactly put in place to protect women from this kind of abuse. And here it is, in the name of Title IX, that the very same disadvantages that are being inflicted on women.
Well, can you imagine women's collegiate basketball? This is going to destroy that, especially after all the gains that they've made with, you know, viewership with Caitlin Clark and others.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a safety element, right? Especially when you're moving into these sports that, if not outrightly contact sports, they can easily become an involved contact. I mean, it's not safe to have women in the same competitive sphere as men. I mean, you know, especially when you get to things like wrestling. I mean, these are not made up examples. There have been women who have been seriously injured from these kinds of policies, and it just goes to show, as Riley Gaines put it, this reckless disregard for women in all this, just to appease the feeling of a small minority of men who, frankly, have this delusion that they're a woman. And somebody just needs to be able to take some leadership on this and say, I'm sorry, you're not. You're entitled to live out your private fantasies, but you're not entitled to take away the rights of other people.
Well, so this is on the ballot in November, too, because the only way that this gets undone, I mean, I understand Independent Women's Forum has a complaint at the ready, but through the courts, okay, but in terms of executive action on this, the only way this gets undone is with a change in administration. And that needs to come, you know, pretty quickly, because it's one of those things that the further down the road this gets, the more difficult it is to retrace your steps, as we've seen over and over again. And of course, the identitarians know this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, the point I would make about the previous Trump administration was that what they did was actually a lot of damage control from the Obama era, because all of this actually started with Obama sending out Dear College letters, advising schools. And again, it was very surreptitious. It was below the radar. It's really sneaky how they go about it. And we've seen that with Biden's Secretary of Education as well. You know, and actually the Trump administration were trying to undo all of this damage and put some proper protocols in place. But they were also trying to give schools and the public some clarity and say, look, sex is objective, it's immutable. We have no reason to think that it's anything other than that. And in fact, you can't really base a policy on anything other than that. The Biden administration tries to appeal to the precedent set in the Bostock decision in 2019, which was a really not good decision for the side of sanity, but it doesn't say what the Biden administration pretends it does. And it was specifically limited to Title VII, which relates to employment. And we're talking about education. We're talking about Title IX. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. The best case scenario would be that Republicans could get in and sort of clean house here, because it really is. It is just so far reaching. And in the meantime, you know, this legislation, or it was not legislation, this order goes into effect August 1st. And so, yeah, there's going to be, before we get this lawsuit off the ground, there's going to be damage and there's going to be massive confusion, and that should be avoided.
Madeline Kearns, writer at National Review, visiting fellow at the Independent Women's Forum. Madeline, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, all right, I've got the basis for the recall election. You know, that dude in Lakeview that lives by you is trying to get a recall.
Yeah, we had him on the show when you were gone.
He's trying to get a recall. Okay, trying to get a recall ordinance on recall question on the ballot to have an ordinance to ultimately recall BLM Brandon. I've got the entire basis for the campaign. It's this.
Incredible legends, Dick Butkus and Mike Dicta.
Who?
Incredible legends, Dick Butkus and Mike Dicta.
Mike Dicta. You cannot mispronounce Mike Ditka's name and live in Chicago.
Doesn't happen.
That's
recallable right there, Dan, for you?
I think that's the entire campaign. I think you just play that two-second bite on a continuous loop for the next 3 years.
Yeah.
Talk about the
incredible legends, Dick Butkus and Mike Dicta.
I mean, come on. Coach. We got to get reaction to that.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Chinese government poses, quote, broad and unrelenting threat to U.S. critical infrastructure, says FBI Director Christopher Wray. Yawn! I'm just tired of it. I mean, especially when I know Christopher Wray and this administration are relatively unserious about the Chinese Communist Party. But Gray uses that sort of those sorts of warnings for very short-term political reasons. Like that was a statement that he made before the FISA surveillance Section 702 was renewed for another 2 years by Congress. The deal that Mike Johnson cut. That did include no warrant provision for Americans, despite some 285,000 instances of abuse of 702 by the FBI. So we listened to some dissertation on the Chinese Communist threat. And by the way, I'm not saying that he's wrong about the Chinese Communist Party. I'm just saying that they're unserious. This administration is unserious about it. And now there's been some response to Trump's aggressive protectionist policies in the direction of the Chinese Communist Party from the Biden administration because it had gone unresponded to for long enough that they saw an opportunity now to pivot and attack Trump for supposedly promoting policies that would weaken the U.S. dollar to reduce our trade deficit with the Chinese Communist Party. And again, with China vis-a-vis the Chinese Communist Party, the totalitarians in control, President Xi. And again, I'm not a fan of Trump's mercantilist policies, and I think we want a strong dollar, and trade deficits don't matter that very much to me and other free market economists. But again, it's the contrived nature of the pronouncements in the direction of communist China that come from this administration, that is the issue as far as I'm concerned. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined again by our friend Gordon Chang. He is the author of The Coming Collapse of China and the Great U.S.-China Tech War. And you can follow him on Twitter and should at Gordon G. Chang, C-H-A-N-G, Gordon G. Chang is his handle on Twitter/X. Gordon Chang, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, Dan and Amy.
So with respect to, Ray's general warnings about the Communist Party, I mean, it's nothing new. It's nothing that anybody paying attention doesn't know. And I have you're closer to it than I am, but I haven't seen any great announcements of new initiatives that are designed to address these threats that Christopher Wray talks about intermittently.
Yes, the timing is suspicious. China has posed a threat to U.S. critical infrastructure, but that's been true for decades. And what we're seeing in the Biden administration are actually some acts that have encouraged bad actors to attack us. So, for instance, if you go back to 2021, the Colonial Pipeline hack, the Biden administration did not oppose the paying of a ransom to the Russian hacking group. And I think that that did encourage, and we saw other attacks against infrastructure, which were for the purpose of obtaining ransom. This is just something that the Biden administration isn't serious about. If they were serious, they would be going after this with much more vigor.
What is your assessment of the relative strength of President Xi's position as the dictator of that country? I had a conversation with Stephen Mosher from the Population Research Institute, and he sort of I think he's sort of generally in agreement with you that that the Chinese Communist Party is suffering under the weight of the internal contradictions and the impossibility of autocracies being growth oriented, real growth oriented in a sustainable way. And that that maybe the Berlin Wall moment in Beijing is not as far off as some think.
Yeah, there are real problems inside, and it starts with the economy, which didn't grow 5.3% in the first quarter of this year, as reported, didn't grow 5.2% last year, as reported. We don't know exactly how fast the Chinese economy grew, but if it did, probably no more than 1.5% last year and less in the first quarter. This is a problem because the economy was the motor of China's rise, and the Chinese people are suffering. Right now, they're suffering from not only not having jobs, but their store of value, which is the property sector. 70% of China's wealth is in property. That property sector has been collapsing. Mm-hmm. And so the Chinese people aren't too happy with Xi Jinping right now.
Yeah, but so he still, at least he's perceived to have a stranglehold on the party and thus power. And, I know that that can sometimes change in a hurry. But is there any suggestion that, there is a revolt afoot internally or externally?
Dan, we're seeing signs that do not occur in periods of stability. So, for instance, there have been purges both in the Chinese military and in the civilian ranks of the Communist Party. And these are quite unusual. So, for instance, in just one example, in the Rocket Force, which controls almost all of the country's nuclear weapons, some 70 were disappeared in the last half of last year, according to some reports. We know that it's confirmed that the top two officers were sacked. A deputy commander, we believe, committed suicide in early July. This is just stunning, and we have not seen this except for periods where the party has been at great risk. The Chinese system is very opaque right now, so we have less and less idea what's going on, but we're seeing things that are really very disturbing.
Does it parallel the, the last days of Mao? But I mean, really, by that I mean Mao's death throes, which ushered in the Cultural Revolution, where he murdered 20 million people. I mean, are we on the cusp of death throes, but death throws that don't have it's I don't mean that in an immediacy way. Death throes, the decline, but then a period of even more grotesque oppression and killing than has otherwise been attendant to President Xi's reign.
We're seeing signs of purges. We don't know if people have actually been put to death, but we see certainly things that suggest that Xi Jinping is taking pages out of Mao Zedong's playbook. And one of them it affects us, and that is that he is creating incidents abroad with regard to Taiwan, mm-hmm. more specifically with regard to the Philippines. And this is really, and I think he's doing it to mobilize the Chinese people, and he's doing it to prevent other senior leaders from attacking him. So this is creating all sorts of disturbances in East Asia, which is pushing the world to war.
So the money that was part of that $95 billion foreign aid package that Biden recently signed, money, the smaller portion of the money going to Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific, is that substantial? How is that received by Beijing? What, if anything else, should we be doing to help Taiwan?
Well, it was welcome, but I don't think it was substantial. We can prevent war across the Taiwan Strait, and it's not so much a question of the military balance of power, but it's the President of the United States making it clear to China that we will defend Taiwan. If we do that, there won't be any war. And really what they're looking at is a situation in South Korea where we say we will defend South Korea. We have a tripwire force there that is not adequate to prevent North Korea from taking over South Korea. But the North Koreans don't invade because they don't want to take on the U.S. We could do the same thing in Taiwan, but the president doesn't want to do that, which means that we could very well have war in the Taiwan Strait.
Well, speaking of that huge foreign aid package, part of that was a bill to require TikTok to separate from the Chinese parent company or face a nationwide ban. Now they, ByteDance has 9 months to sell TikTok. Do you think they're going to do it? And are they spying on us?
I don't think they will. They've been very clear that they said they're not going anywhere. They're going to challenge it on constitutional grounds. I don't think they really have constitutional grounds because we're not trying to regulate content. We're trying to go after conduct, as Senator Marco Rubio says. So we know that the Chinese have used TikTok to steal data from Americans and use it for from very malicious purposes in terms of the videos that they send around. So we have every right to disconnect TikTok, but I don't believe that they're going to sell it. They're going to try to fight this to the end.
You know, Trump has talked about 10% across the board tariffs and even perhaps more usurious tariffs on particular products or sectors in China. If China is not stable, as you're suggesting, and you know, based on the indications that you were describing, what sorts of policies, economic and political, would you be recommending to this president or a subsequent one to hasten the demise of the Chinese Communist Party's control over that country?
Well, like you, Dan, I'm a free trader, but I do believe we need substantial, certainly far more substantial tariffs than we have on China right now, for the simple reason that they've been continuing to steal U.S. intellectual property. And Trump's 2018 tariffs were imposed under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974 to remedy the theft of intellectual property. So we need to do these things, and they are dangerous. But the point is, after three decades of misguided China policy, every course of action for us is misguided and dangerous. It's dangerous and risky. And I think that essentially we have got to take some risks right now if we want to save our society.
And are we getting, are we seeing, and just in terms of like, you know, trying to read trends, are we seeing the repatriation of U.S. companies or the reorganization of supply lines outside of that included China to friendlier countries in the Pacific Rim, places like Asia, I mean, like India, but smaller countries too, like Thailand or Vietnam. Is that still ongoing as it started in during COVID?
Well, that certainly is ongoing, and we see, for instance, companies moving to Mexico to take advantage of USMCA, the free trade agreement. And some of those companies are actually Chinese, but we saw last year a decoupling of the U.S. and China. So, for instance, China's exports to the U.S. fell more than 20%, merchandise exports, and overall trade fell 16.7%. Our exports to China fell 4.3%. So the decoupling process is occurring. It's not occurring fast enough, but it is necessary to protect our factories from unfair and predatory competition from China. Some of that competition is actually criminal.
What about substantial spike in Chinese migrants that are arriving at our southern border and making their way in, like migrants from other countries? You know, single military age men. You know, the understanding I have is that nobody leaves China without the Communist Party knowing it. So if these people are leaving, then it's with the assent of President Xi. Now, it doesn't mean that they're all essentially sleeper operators or agents of the Communist Party. Some could be economic migrants, but again, they still have to get the nod to leave. So how should we understand, you know, the tens of thousands of Chinese migrants that have come to this country over the last 12 months?
That's really disturbing. If we go back 2 years, we saw primarily family groups from China coming across our southern border. And those were desperate middle-class Chinese who had given up on their country. What we're seeing now is something like 80 to 85% of the Chinese migrants are, as you described, single males traveling in packs of 5 to 15 without family members of military age. And Border Patrol knows that some of them have links to the Chinese military. We know that China has, for instance, that one secret Chinese biological weapons facility in Reedley, California, that was found last year. It could not have been the only one. We got to worry that these migrants are going to come here and link up with those facilities, spread disease around the U.S., do God knows what else.
So is my understanding what I suggested about how people are able to leave China? Is that right, that nobody leaves without approval? So there is knowledge of and some sort of purpose or multiple purposes behind who the Chinese Communist Party is allowing to leave?
Well, the Communist Party knows who is leaving, but they don't need approval. I mean, people are able to leave without the approval of the party. And they can do that by just pretending to be tourists, which some of them actually do. People are escaping. But the party runs a near total surveillance state, so if it wants to, it can stop the flow of people out of the country. So far, it's embarrassed by this, but it hasn't taken extremely coercive steps to stop it because it's still continuing. But you know, you're right. A lot of the people who are coming across our country now into our country from the southern and also the northern border are operatives, and the Biden administration doesn't seem to care very much about it.
Gordon Chang is the author of The Coming Collapse of China and The Great U.S.-China Tech War. Again, follow him on X at Gordon G. Chang, at Gordon G. C-H-A-N-G, Gordon G. Chang. Gordon Chang, thank you as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Dan and Amy. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
I just got to play this again. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Incredible legends, Dick Butkus and Mike Dicta.
Got a little nervous, man. The world was watching. They wanted to unveil their new plans for a new stadium that I don't think is going to happen. Guess what, though? Guess what LC said, Dan? If we build a new stadium, guess what's going to happen? We're going to have a better, safer, stronger Chicago. Yes.
Mike Dicta. That is worse than when Tiny Dancer referred to the Bears record as 3-0.
Oh, you will not let that go either.
BLM Brando, what a dork. Mike Dicta? You can't be the mayor of Chicago and mispronounce Mike Ditka's name. I that is disqualifying.
All right.
By the way, on the sports beat,
yes, sir.
We didn't get to it with Madeline Kearns, but I did. You know, all those female college basketball coaches. Well, I mean, it's men and women, but they're women's team coaches,
right,
who refuse to take a position on men playing women's sports, men playing women's basketball. Isn't it time we ask Caitlin Clark? Now that she's got her big Nike deal, I want to hear from Caitlin Clark on the topic.
I would love to know what she thinks of that. Yeah. Or Angel Reese, who's now going to be with the Chicago Sky, or any of them. I mean, their jobs are on the line.
Caitlin Clark's the face of women's basketball right now, I want to hear from her first.
Okay. Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560.
It's coming Mother's Day. I'm so excited. So treat the mom in your life to a very special Mother's Day brunch at the Trump Hotel in Chicago. You know the date. Sunday, May 12th, enjoy a buffet-style feast with live entertainment and complimentary champagne while seated along the city skyline for a chance to win tickets. 560theanswer.com, keyword mother. 560theanswer.com, keyword mother, and good luck.
We got this guy at, I guess it's either the Columbia or if there was an encampment at NYU. I'm not sure which encampment, but he's in New York. And, it's smart and funny. And ridicule is a powerful tool against the ignorant. So he dresses up like Moses, and he's dressed up like Moses.
Did you tweet this out, by the way?
I will. Okay. Let my people go is the theme here. And he goes up to people and just asks them a simple question. And depending on their response, he has a response. This is, a good way to go about this. I like this guy.
Hello, I'm Moses, and welcome to Let My People Go, the game show. Let's play. Do you think Hamas should release the hostages?
I think that the Zionist entity...
Sorry, man. It was an unequivocal yes I needed. I have frogs for you. It's one of the plagues. What are your guys' names?
Sir.
Chuck.
Should Hamas release the Israeli hostages? How about you? So you guys say no?
No.
Well, I'm so sorry, then. This Passover, all I can offer you guys is hail! Will you call on Hamas to release the hostages?
I'm not going to answer that.
You sure?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. Then all I can offer you is water turned into blood. Do you think Hamas should release the Israeli hostages?
I don't know about that, man.
I can still offer you a prize. Lice, do you think Hamas should release the hostages?
No.
All I have then is a plague, blindness, darkness, sleep at night. Will you call on Hamas to release the Israeli hostages?
Why do you think they took hostages?
I think they took hostages because they're a terrorist group that want to kill Jews, because that's what they've said in their charter.
You think maybe the only thing they've ever been shown is hostility and violence?
Did you guys know that Israel left Gaza in 2005?
Not that up to date with that history.
All I can offer you guys is locusts!
Amazing. Are they real?
Moral of the story, Jews have been persecuted for over 3,000 years. We always survive and usually make a holiday out of it. Let's let our people go. Back to Israel.
It was funny, and he's got all the different, he's got like plastic frogs for the plague, and he's got it's good. It's very creative. I like it. It's one way to do it, and to expose the ignorance, as you heard at the end, but also to expose the actual views. So you have people saying at this encampment in New York, all these young people, college students. I don't support the release of hostages.
Do they even know that five of them are Americans?
I'm sure they don't, but it's just incredible some of the things that we're hearing from the mouths of these babes out there, aren't we? Something else too. I mean, just how next level this is going, and I mean our culture generally. Amherst, Massachusetts. And this could be Wilmette, this could be Hinsdale, River Forest. It would get the same response. There's a new iteration of Drag Queen Story Hour. Free Palestine Drag Queen Story Hour.
Oh.
Not kidding.
However,
Valley Families for Palestine Drag Queen Story Hour in Amherst, Massachusetts. Listen to this. From the dude parading as a woman in front of parents with their basically toddlers.
Okay, gross, but I want to hear it.
Today what we're going to do is we're going to shout, Free Palestine. Can I hear that?
Free Palestine!
If you're a drag queen and you know it, shout,
Free Palestine!
If you're a drag queen and you know it and you really want to show it, if you're a drag queen and you know it, shout,
Oh my God. Well, does that drag queen know that if that drag queen showed up in Gaza wearing that, they would throw said person off of roof?
A nice twofer there. You have the promotion of radical Islamist terrorism and gender identity, nonsensical gender identity politics. It's a wonderful twofer. It covers a lot of turf. For more on all of this, because the college campuses are ground zero, as we've been discussing the last several days, Scott Walker joins us. He's the president and CEO of Young America's Foundation, of course, former two-term governor of Wisconsin and former presidential candidate. Governor Walker, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good to be with you. Good morning. We were just hearing from Peter Schweitzer, the obviously New York Times bestselling author. He's got another book out called Blood Money. But Peter is an alum of YF, and we just heard from him last night again. And he talks about how, you know what this all ties together to, the Chinese Communist Party, because their attempt to attack us, to declare war on us, is not to declare war, but to fund things like this transgender nonsense that we see here in America, but not in China, to fund things like the problems we have at the border, and to fund things like the social media division that we have that drives students to not even know what they're talking about. I mean, for goodness sake, they're so intimidated in those debates or in those riots and protests that they can't even acknowledge what most human beings would say was an obvious answer, was of course they should release the hostages. The weirdest thing with all of this is, you know, one of the guys with the most clarity on this issue, apparently you just got to go to Walter Reed to get clarity, is Senator John Fetterman, who's right on the money, at least when it comes to Hamas and Israel these days. Who would have thought?
And why isn't President Biden, I mean, he's had so many campaign appearances, why doesn't he talk about it while, you know, he's got the chance to?
Well, you saw why the other day. I mean, for goodness sakes, he was with AOC, you know, talking about this on Earth Day about climate stuff. They asked him, and he pulled the very thing that they tried to mock Donald Trump on years ago back in Virginia. He, you know, they're good people on both sides. Remember, I mean, that's essentially what he said, was that, he made some lame defense of extremism at one point and then said, but, you know, there are good people on the other side. But those weren't his exact words. But it's because he doesn't know what he thinks. His instinct was to be protective of Israel, because that's where he and most Democrats were for the last 40, 50 years, as well as Republicans, obviously our greatest ally in the area, in the Middle East, the only democracy in the Middle East. And yet he knows that with some extreme younger voters, and certainly with some voters in a key state like Michigan, they're somehow not just against Israel, but somehow aligned with Hamas. And so they're in such a bind in these polls, not just nationally, as your news just related to, but particularly in battleground states like mine, that they're willing to abandon all that and even undermine. Imagine this for a second. So there, you got him, you've got Chuck Schumer and others undermining the leader of Israel less than 6 months since they had their own 9/11, or actually arguably worse percentage-wise attack. Can you imagine Tony Blair doing that to George W. Bush back in 2001, 2002? I mean, this is how they've just politically sold their souls.
Yeah, but they're not politically naive. And the frightening thing is that they think what they're doing is in their political interest to do so. It's a terrible commentary on where America is.
Well, I hope people are waking up. I mean, we've seen college campuses aren't just liberal. There's not just a left-wing bias. There's outright radicalization on our campuses. And we've been saying this for years, but I hope the images at Columbia, but now all over the country, are just a vivid reminder, not only why we're on campus. Oddly enough, we sent kids out along with our kids and the college Republicans. We helped put up flags, as we've done the last 6 months, Israeli flags in representation of each of the hostages that were taken, just like every year the last 2 decades we put up American flags to represent those who were innocently killed in 9/11, and not just to remember that, remember who did it, why they did it, and that's something that nobody's, or since nobody, hardly any are being taught out there. But it's also why it's not enough to just be on college campuses. We're going younger. We've been in high school. We just started middle school. In fact, in about less than 2 weekends, we'll be in Dixon, Ronald Reagan's boy at home. In fact, if folks are interested, yaf.org/events. We're doing another one of our middle school programs, because we got to start younger and start getting the word out sooner, so that people don't wake up one day and say, how do my kids and my grandkids end up being one of these radicals on the campus?
Well, sure. I mean, you just heard the Free Palestine Drag Queen Story Hour with kids that are maybe not even kindergarten age. I mean, so that's where that's where these cultural Marxists are. I mean, they start at the beginning, which is the right place to start. I wanted to get your reaction, though, too, just on the second on the issue of college. Trump's announcement this week that, you know, his plan for the colleges deport people on student visas who are hate mongers on campus, and then accreditation and endowments use the Department of Education's oversight powers with respect to college accreditation agencies and tax these endowments of these mutual funds masquerading as colleges, like in the Ivy League.
Well, money talks. I mean, that's it. I if there was any mistake, and you know the record I had in Wisconsin, how aggressively we took on the unions, the civil service, the out-of-control bureaucracy, all those sorts of things. The one thing I regret, and we did do things with tenure and free speech, but that we should have done even more on the University of Wisconsin system, and I think that's the key around the country. Governors, lawmakers, at least in states where they're willing to do that, should take action. I think the Department of Education, I think anybody, I think people listening, you give to your alma mater, and your alma mater teaches students these days to hate you, hate the things you stand for, pull the money and tell them why. I think it's finally time that we've got to take action. I don't just think it's not even just that they're not getting a good education, particularly in many of these so-called Ivy League schools. They're actually getting a re-education. It's not just that it's not good stuff they're getting. They're being told and taught and pushed to do stuff that is fundamentally at odds with core American principles, not necessarily Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, just core American principles. So I think we do need to push back. The other piece of good news, and we do polling quite frequently of college plus high school students. Nationwide, despite what you see in the media, college students' number one issue is the economy. And college students agree with us on a lot of things. They don't think boys should be competing in women's sports. They don't think enrollment or even employment should be based on race. There's a lot more college students who have some sense of common sense than you would perceive, but they're intimidated, as are some of their educators, and we got to push back. That's what we do at the Young Americas Foundation. YF.org, if people are feeling under attack, we got you back.
What do you think? I mean, just talking about Wisconsin being a swing state and you knowing it so well, obviously. And it also seems to be sort of the weakest of the swing states for Trump in terms of where he is, is having the most problems shaking Biden, at least at present. What, if anything, does Trump need to be doing that he's not doing to position himself better in Wisconsin?
Well, I think the best thing, this applies nationwide, but it particularly is true in Wisconsin. You've got traditional big cities, nothing like the proportion Chicago versus the rest of Illinois, but Wisconsin, it's big city Milwaukee. Next big city is Madison, although Madison is like Berkeley. I mean, it's way, way out there.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the rural areas are traditionally more Republican, with a few exceptions. And you've got the suburbs, and then in between the swing areas are kind of mid-sized industrial cities. Trump actually does well there, as I did as well. But where he's underperforming in the past, at least in the 2020 election, was in the suburbs. Suburbs go Republican, but you need to up the numbers. To the extent that he can make the case that, yeah, he's a fighter, never going to change that, nor should he, but he's got to be a fighter for you. He's got to be a fighter for the voter. He's got to be a fighter for the forgotten. If he's perceived as a fighter because he just likes to fight, that turns off a lot of suburban, so-called college-educated voters, not just women, but men as well. That's where when he not only when he comes to Wisconsin, but just overall, to the extent that he can show, which he has in the past and which he is, a fighter for the forgotten, a fighter for the people who are frustrated with Washington, a fighter who says, you know, people can say, I'll overlook some of the tweets or comments because he actually gets the job done, unlike a lot of politicians who go to Washington and talk but don't deliver. He needs to be that person, that leader. I think there's a lot of suburban voters who are willing to give up an occasional tweet they don't care for in return for some sort of stability when it comes to the economy, the border, and overall public safety.
He is Scott Walker, former governor of Wisconsin, presidential candidate, now the president of Young Americas Foundation. And again, yeah, the event is the middle school expedition at the Reagan Boyhood Home, Reagan Resilience Challenge in Dixon, obviously. That's next week, May 3rd and 4th. I have that right. Yes, Scott?
Yeah, it's exactly right. Love to have folks come on in. And like we've had great programs for college and high school students, a lot of fun. We just had a group out at the Reagan Ranch. This is at the Reagan Boyd home. YAF.org, yaf.org/events. Well, we'd love to have folks come with their middle schoolers. It can be parent, grandparent, family member. Come and join us. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Very good, yeah. And if you haven't seen Reagan's Boyhood Home, that's a requisite to be a Land of Lincoln resident, I would say. Scott Walker, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Bye now.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.